You're tuned to WFHB
91.3
and 98.1 FM.
Volunteer powered,
listener supported.
Community radio for South Central Indiana.
Welcome to WFHB's Daily Local News.
Written and produced entirely by volunteers from the Bloomington community.
And supported by the generosity of listeners like you.
Good afternoon from the studios of Community Radio 91.3 FM. Reporting live for WFHB, this is Maria McKinley.
And I'm Doug Storm. This is the Daily Local News for Monday, February 20th, 2017.
We are afraid that this will become the model across the country for getting rid of low-income people, effectively seizing their property and transferring it to a private developer.
Low-income residents in Charlestown, Indiana, are fighting back against the city's plan to redevelop their neighborhood. More on that story later in the program.
Also coming up in the next half hour, we talk with a local resident about why he volunteers with several different nonprofits. That's on Activate, our weekly segment spotlighting people working for positive change in our community. But first, these local headlines.
Prospects for redistricting reform in Indiana are looking dim this week. A bill to create an independent commission to draw legislative districts is poised to die in committee without being voted on. The bill, co-authored by House Speaker Brian Bosma, has support from both Republicans and Democrats in the House. But the bill's progress has been halted by Representative Milo Smith, a Republican from Columbus. He chairs the House Elections Committee and has refused to allow the committee to vote on the proposal. Representative Ryan Hatfield, the ranking Democrat on the House Elections Committee, thinks it's unlikely that Smith will approve a vote before the deadline on Wednesday.
Committee normally meets on Wednesdays, and so the last chance we'll have the ability to hear this bill and to send it out of committee will be this Wednesday, February 22nd. We currently don't have a committee hearing planned. I have asked the chairman of the committee to please call a meeting and hear the bill, and or at least allow a vote on the bill, but he has yet to do that, and I don't know if we can expect a committee hearing to be held on Wednesday.
The bill lost momentum last week when Representative Smith told constituents at a town hall meeting that he had concerns about the bill. Smith said the bill would waste legislators' time by requiring two different votes on whether to adopt the commission's proposals, and he wasn't clear on what would happen if those votes failed. The redistricting commission would not be entirely independent, but would be partially bipartisan. Here, Representative Hatfield explains how the commission would be staffed.
The committee, at worst, is bipartisan in their efforts. Four of the nine members are picked by the leadership, one from the Speaker, one from the Minority Leader, both from the House of Representatives, and then one from the President pro tem of the Senate, and one from the Minority Leader of the Senate. That makes up four. An additional four members are picked then out of a pool of 12. That pool of 12 is nominated by the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, the President of Ball State, the President of Indiana University, and the President of Purdue University. Once that pool of 12 is picked and the four existing members from the political appointments choose those four members, then we'll have eight, and then those eight members choose a chairperson.
Final approval would require seven votes out of nine on the commission. Redistricting reform has support from several groups around the state, including the League of Women Voters and Common Cause Indiana. Representative Hatfield said that in recent weeks his office had received more calls about redistricting than any other issue. Legislative districts are redrawn every 10 years following the national census. Indiana's next round of redistricting is scheduled for 2021.
Solar energy advocates continued their criticism of Senate Bill 309 today. The bill takes aim at net metering, a process in which solar energy customers sell extra power back to the grid. The bill was approved by the Senate Utilities Committee on Thursday. This morning, the Indiana Distributed Energy Alliance issued a press release criticizing the bill and its author, State Senator Brant Hirschman. The alliance says Hirschman made false statements in his explanation of the bill's effects. In its statement, the Energy Alliance encourages the Utilities Committee to reconvene so that Hirschman's statements can be corrected and the senators can vote again. On Friday, we spoke with another opponent of Senate Bill 309, the executive director of the Hoosier Environmental Council, Jess Kurbanda. He says the bill could harm the state in the long run.
Solar ends up putting a lot more benefit to the grid than it imposes on the grid. And to forcibly devalue solar in the way that SB 309 would do would really discourage long-term investment in solar energy.
Kurbanda went on to say that solar energy still has considerable room to expand in the state of Indiana.
The price of solar has gone down to such a degree over the last 5 to 10 years, more than 70% reduced on a per unit of energy basis. And it's just the opportunity where solar can be in grasp of middle-class Hoosiers and working-class Hoosiers and low-income Hoosiers. And so for us to radically change our public policy when it comes to solar energy would be a very unwise decision. Indiana has tremendous potential to be a major player in solar energy, which is an industry that has over 200,000 jobs in the United States. But SB 309 would send Indiana in the wrong direction. It would worsen Indiana's reputation in clean energy, building upon a very bad decision that was made in 2014, where Indiana became the first state in the country to eliminate its energy savings program.
According to the Tribune Star newspaper, Indiana homeowners and businesses using solar panels can sell excess energy to the power grid for about 11 cents per kilowatt hour. The utility companies that manage the power grid can get that energy from other sources for as little as 3.5 cents per kilowatt hour. If passed, the effects of Senate Bill 309 would start in 2022. The bill has not yet been voted on by the full Senate.
On Saturday, March 4th, the Bloomington Symphony Orchestra will present Scene Change, Music of Latin America, at the Buskirk Chumley Theater in Bloomington. The concert will feature the symphony with special guests from Indiana University's Latin American Music Center. They will perform music by composers from Brazil, Chile, Colombia, and Peru. In a press release, the artistic director and conductor of the orchestra, Alejandro Gomez Guillen, singled out one of his great influences, Chilean composer Juan Orega Salas, whose work Ash Wednesday will make its world premiere at the concert. More information may be found by calling 812-323-3020. Reporting live for WFHB, I'm Doug Storm.
And I'm Maria McKinley. Residents of a low-income neighborhood in southern Indiana say the city government is forcing them out of their homes to clear the way for a private developer. Correspondent Jared Dill has the story.
Residents of one working-class neighborhood in Charlestown, Indiana, are fighting a legal battle to keep the city from replacing it with an upscale development. Pleasant Ridge, which sits virtually in the center of Charlestown, is home to roughly 1,000 of the city's 9,000 inhabitants. The neighborhood is mostly prefabricated duplexes built to serve as housing for workers at a nearby munitions plant. It is one of the cheapest places in the city to live. A little over half of the neighborhood is rental housing. Things began to change last year with the opening of the Lewis and Clark Bridge, which crosses the Ohio River to Louisville, as well as an influx of new employers. The longtime mayor, Bob Hall, saw a new future for Charlestown as a posh bedroom community for professionals working in Louisville. This was reflected in his reelection campaign as well as city documents. But that future doesn't include a neighborhood of run-down World War II-era housing. With private developer Nice Ventures ready to turn the neighborhood into a multi-use subdivision, the mayor and the city council approved a redevelopment plan in November. I spoke with Josh Craven, a resident of Pleasant Ridge and a member of the Neighborhood Association. Here, he describes the city's use of code enforcement to begin pushing landlords into selling their properties.
They have a citywide rental inspection program where they inspect rental properties, but the qualifications for to have your home inspected are your house has to be at least 60 years old, it has to have originally been built on a not on a solid foundation, and it had to have been originally built with what is deemed today as hazardous materials. And our homes are the only ones in Charlestown that meet all three of those qualifications.
Fines were issued for ripped screens, gutters, moss growth, missing lattices under porches, and other related violations. The fines increased every day the issues weren't fixed, but the city also passed a resolution allowing the council to demand fines even after repairs were made. The city offered to waive fines if a house was demolished or sold to the developer for a third of the market value. The fines added up fast, often into the thousands of dollars within days. Most landlords who owned rental properties quickly took the offer. When discussing the Neighborhood Association's experience at a city council meeting, Craven referenced an ordinance that actually allowed the city to pre-screen and silence anyone from Pleasant Ridge who wanted to speak at the meeting. You can hear the incredulity in my voice when I ask him to elaborate.
3 days in advance, and then they approve it.
Really? So you can't comment at city council meetings unless you sign up in advance and they approve it?
Yes. City council meetings are on Monday, so you have to have it in by Thursday at 5 o'clock, and then they'll approve it to be put on the agenda. If they don't like what you're up there to talk about, or if it's controversial or something of that nature, they have the power to just say, no, we're not going to do that. We're not going to put you on the agenda to talk.
I looked up the resolution, and it turned out to be exactly what Josh Craven described. The resolution even specified that council members had a right to speak at meetings, but public comment was a privilege granted at the discretion of the council. The mayor and the rest of the city council have also gone out of their way to paint Pleasant Ridge as a hotspot of crime and drug use to justify the redevelopment. They say 50% of the city's 911 calls come from that area, but Craven disagreed, pointing out that the proportion of calls is meaningless without actual numbers.
And I mean, they always use the crime, and I'll go back to that. I mean, they always use the crime as an issue, but they say 50% of the police calls come to our neighborhood. I dispute that a little bit. I may say 30 to 40, but even at that, I mean, 30 to 40% of what's the actual number, though? They'll never give us the actual number. So, what is it, 30 to 40% of 10? Or is it 30 to 40% of 100? They won't never give us that number, so then therefore, as long as you're making it sound like the percentage is high, then it makes us look bad. But the actual number, if you got 10 police calls, and we got four of them, I mean, is four police calls for 1,000 people, is that really that bad?
The Neighborhood Association has enlisted the help of the Institute for Justice, a nonprofit, libertarian-leaning law firm, to bring their case against the city. I spoke with lead attorney Jeff Rose, and he says the city is operating in blatant violation of the state's unsafe building law. That law contains fairly robust protections against the seizure of private property for the purpose of turning it over to a developer.
The city of Charlestown is using code enforcement, ticketing, in order to force people to sell their property to a private developer. That violates the unsafe building law. The unsafe building law makes it clear that you can't do what Charlestown is doing, and that is assessing gigantic fines immediately and having fines accumulate every day.
Some of these fines have topped six figures on houses with a current market value of less than $30,000. Altogether, the neighborhood likely has millions of dollars in outstanding fines. Most landlords saw those fines and bolted, selling off their property to the developers almost immediately. But, according to Rose and the Institute's filing, collection of the fines was deferred because the developer planned to demolish those properties. In the meantime, tenants continue to live in houses that were deemed dangerous enough to merit massive fines before the developer bought them. He says this is just one of several constitutional violations at work in this case.
The city is violating not only its own ordinances and Indiana state law, the city is violating multiple provisions of both the Indiana and federal constitutions. So, for example, there is evidence that the city is targeting the neighborhood and association for code enforcement because it has been opposing the city politically. That's a First Amendment violation. The city has been conducting unconstitutional searches, which violates the Fourth Amendment. The city has imposed these massive fines for trivial problems with property, and that actually violates the Eighth Amendment's provision against excessive fines. That's a little obscure. People aren't used to hearing about that, but that's going on. The city is also violating equal protection. It's treating the developer differently in the neighborhood than it's treating regular homeowners. And last, the city is violating due process by using code enforcement as a way to get around Indiana's good eminent domain law, which protects property owners from this kind of mass redevelopment.
It's worth pointing out that the use of code citations to clear residents out of Pleasant Ridge isn't Mayor Hall's first attempt. In 2014, he sought to use an urban blight grant to demolish the neighborhood, but was eventually blocked in that effort. Rose also mentioned that the residents of Pleasant Ridge actually did manage to elect one of their own to the city council, Tina Barnes. But Rose claims that she was marginalized on the council and unable to affect council business. I was not able to speak with Barnes herself to elaborate on that claim. The Institute for Justice is hoping to use this case to establish a precedent. They say circumvention of eminent domain protections is a national trend.
The reason why the Institute for Justice took on this case to represent the homeowners is that we're afraid that this will become the model across the country for getting rid of low-income people, effectively seizing their property and transferring it to a private developer. In 2006, the state of Indiana reformed its eminent domain law and made it very, very difficult to seize the property of low-income people to transfer it to a developer. And what the mayor and the developer have done here is implement a scheme to get around that. And so we need to stop it here, not just to protect our clients in the Pleasant Ridge neighborhood, but to make sure that this doesn't become the nationwide model for avoiding good eminent domain reform.
Attorney Mike Gillenwater, who is representing the city in the case, spoke with me at length about issues with the neighborhood. From the city's perspective, they're trying to renew a blighted neighborhood full of homes that are 60 years past their projected lifespan. He also pointed out that the city's inspection program only applies to rental properties and that no action has been taken against homeowners. He also said the city has several programs to assist residents in finding new housing, including a program called Pathway to Home Ownership. When asked about the city's legal argument in the case, he said only that the city was exercising its right to enforce building codes. I followed up with Josh Craven about the question of what the city would do with owner-occupied homes, since the development cannot move forward without the entire neighborhood. He agreed that no action has been taken against homeowners, but believed the city would eventually start levying fines against them. As for the Pathway to Home Ownership, he said only two of the roughly 30 applicants even qualified for the program. Special thanks to the Louisville Courier-Journal for their continuing coverage of this story. For WFHB, I'm Jared Dill.
Support for WFHB and the Daily Local News comes from Smithville Fiber, a local provider of internet, voice, and TV service, now also offering home automation and security systems for homes and offices throughout South Central Indiana. More information on Smithville's home automation service is available at smithvillesecurity.com.
Now it's time for Activate, our weekly segment spotlighting people working for positive change in our community.
Welcome to Activate, featuring tales of inspiration from local citizens who stand up for what they believe in and encouraging you to find your cause, live your passion, make a difference. Volunteer.
Hi, my name is Keith Bobe. I'm a retired high school teacher, and I volunteer for the Community Kitchen, the Shalom Center, the Interfaith Winter Shelter, New Hope Family Shelter, and I just completed my first weekend of training for CASA. You know, what inspires me is the people in the organization that have committed their time and energy to, in this community kitchen, to seeing that people who are hungry are fed, you know, at the Interfaith Winter Shelter, seeing that people who don't have a place at night have a place, a warm place to stay and some food. You know, at the New Hope Family Shelter, it's more about the families who just need a place to stay temporarily. And they're, you know, they're on their way to permanent housing somewhere, but, you know, there's a lot of kids involved. And then the kids need some daycare during the summer, which is what I was involved in. In CASA, there's such a need for people to represent children in the court system. So that, I haven't done that yet, but I'm training for that, and I'm excited about that in the future. I guess it's opened my eyes just to see the need in the local community for all these services. You can't have too many volunteers, you know. And then the nice thing about, I think, every organization that I'm involved in is the attitude, the personality of the volunteers and the staff. I mean, I just love working here because the staff, you know, they're lively, they play the music, and there's a lot of different activities that I could be involved in. This is my fifth year at the community kitchen, and there's always something to do. And at Shalom Center, every once in a while, and at the Interfaith Winter Shelter as well, you hear somebody say, I got a job, or I got a place to stay. And it's interesting because the positive thing is when you don't see them anymore. You know, they don't need these services, and you know they made it, they're on their own, they got over the hump. That's when I think, you know, what I've been doing for them for the last year or two or whatever, got them over the hump, got them a place to shower, and they feel good about themselves and where they've been to where they've come. Thanks for listening. I'm Keith Bobe, and I work at many volunteer agencies in the community.
You may visit the City of Bloomington Volunteer Network website to see a full organization profile at bloomington.in.gov/volunteer. Now here's a rundown of current volunteer opportunities in Bloomington and Monroe County.
For the City of Bloomington Volunteer Network, I'm Lucy Shake with three ways to volunteer for organizations supporting individuals in need. Volunteers make the community kitchen run. You can help prepare and serve free meals 6 days a week for in-house and carry-out patrons. No previous experience is needed, just a willingness to help. There are two volunteer shifts daily, Monday through Saturday. The prep shift is from 11:30 a.m. to 1:30 p.m., and the serving shift is from 3:30 to 6:30 p.m. Or help with the everyday operation of the Shalom Community Center. Hospitality volunteers are needed to work at the busy front desk distributing guests' mail, answering phones, assisting with long and short-term storage, registering guests to do laundry, take a shower, or see a caseworker. Or learn more about how to become a court-appointed special advocate and join this dedicated group of volunteers who are empowered to help children in need as trained officers of the court. CASA speak on behalf of the child in court, monitor court orders and case plans to make sure that the case is moving forward. Trainings are scheduled year-round. And that's a look at just some of the ways you can connect to your community through volunteering. For WFHB and the City of Bloomington Volunteer Network, I'm Lucy Shake.
You've been listening to Activate, a co-production of WFHB and the City of Bloomington Volunteer Network, working together to build an empowered, vibrant, and engaged community. You may visit bloomington.in.gov/volunteer to find and sign up for local volunteer opportunities. All episodes of Activate are available online at wfhb.org/news/activate. For Bloomington Community Radio, I'm Jennifer Brooks.
You've been listening to the Daily Local News on WFHB. Today's headlines were written by Sheila Raghavendran, Kathy Norton, and Jared Dill. Our feature was produced by Jared Dill.
Activate is produced by Jennifer Brooks along with the City of Bloomington Volunteer Network. Our engineer is Sarah Hetrick. Our theme music is provided by The Impossible Shapes. Executive producer is Joe Crawford. For WFHB, I'm Doug Storm.
And I'm Maria McKinley. Thanks for supporting Indiana's only volunteer-powered, listener-supported, independent daily news program. You can hear tonight's full broadcast as well as all other WFHB news programming online at WFHB.org.
You can be a part of our award-winning news team. For more information about joining our volunteer team of citizen journalists, email news@WFHB.org.
Now stay tuned for KiteLine, a program amplifying the voices of those within Indiana's prison system. Coming up next on WFHB.
The Daily Local News is produced by a staff of over 50 volunteers
working in the WFHB News and Public Affairs Department.
Comments, suggestions, and story ideas
may be submitted directly to our news staff via email.
The address is news@wfhb.org.